Good morning. We'd like to welcome you to session 333 of this year's Sunstone Symposium. My name is Paul Tinker, and I'm chairing this session. The session is entitled The Gay Mormon Literature Project. And what we're going to do here is learn what the Literature Project is, and we're going to have some very astute and expert commentary about the project. So let me get right to the business of introducing our speakers. The person who organized this panel and who is the instigator, so to speak, of the Gay Mormon Literature Project is my longtime friend Jerry Argetsinger, who is associate professor in the Department of Cultural and Creative Studies, NTID, Jerry, tell me.
National Technical Institute for the Deaf.
National Technical Institute for the Deaf. He just puts the initials in here. At the Rochester Institute of Technology in Rochester, New York. He has an MA and a PhD from Bowling Green State University in Ohio and a BA in theater from BYU. He's written many different things in many different areas of study, including books on Scandinavian theater, and has translated Danish plays for the English-speaking audience. He's written a number of scripts of plays, including topics on women's rights and the equality movement of the 19th century. He served a mission to Denmark and was the artistic director of the Hill Cumorah pageant from the years 1990 to 1997. He and his wife Gail serve on the Bi-State Public Relations Committee in Rochester. Jerry has, this is really his first time at a Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, and it's been more than 20 years since he has presented at any symposium. So we're glad to have him here for symposium. Our second speaker is Melissa Leilani Larson, an award-winning playwright and screenwriter based in Provo, Utah. She holds an MFA from the Iowa Playwrights Workshop, as well as a BA in English from BYU. She's written a number of plays which have been in production. Her screen adaptation of Standing Still Standing won the 2006 LDS Film Festival Feature Writing Competition. Mel teaches dramatic writing at Utah Valley University, and she's a proud member of the Dramatists Guild of America. Our third presenter is Johnny Townsend. Johnny has an MFA from Louisiana State University and a bachelor's degree from the University of New Orleans. His primary field is in writing fiction. He's published numerous articles and short stories in such places as Newsday, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, Dialogue, and Sunstone. When we get into the bibliography part of this, you'll see that Johnny is the most frequent author in Jerry's bibliography. Johnny lives in Seattle, at Rainier Beach, with his partner Gary, who is here also. And our fourth presenter is Jonathan Langford, a freelance writer and editor. His first novel, which is germane to the topic here, is called No Going Back, and it's due out from Zarahemla Books this fall. Jonathan has bachelor's and master's degrees from BYU. He currently lives in River Falls, Wisconsin, with his wife and three children. Some of you will know Jonathan as a former moderator of the AML list. So, with that, Jerry, the time is yours, and we'll move forward.
The size of this room is rather daunting. I wish we were in a little more intimate space. I much prefer that. You'll probably realize that this entire panel is unprepared, unrehearsed, and probably uncalled for. But nevertheless, here we are. My presentation is rather bibliographic, and of course I'm not going to read a bibliography to you. I'm introducing the project, telling a little bit about it, and I will have complete notes for you afterward. My paper is 18 pages long. The presentation is only about 7 pages long, so you're getting a little less than half of what's actually available. Last night we were at Kinko's copying this, and I discovered that it's expensive to copy in Utah. It's $2 a set, so there's only 50 copies, but I think we're going to be pretty good for that. The young man working the night shift at Kinko's came over to help us out, and he looked at the title and says, "What's that?" I says, "Well, it's kind of a little thing for Sunstone." He says, "No, that looks interesting." I says, "Kind of an unusual topic." And he says, "I think it's fabulous." So I said, "You'd like a copy, wouldn't you?" And he said, "Could I?" So he read it last night, and he liked it. So I hope you like it as much as the guy at Kinko's did. I will be giving a background and parameters of the study, an introduction to the bibliography, and discuss emerging themes and directions for the project. Besides these three authors who are here, Jeff Lavers, also in the audience, is one of the authors on the bibliography. It's also great to see friends here. I was in Bowling Green, Ohio 30 years ago with Michael, whom I haven't seen till yesterday. A member of my ward from Rochester, who's entering the Mission Home Wednesday, is coming in. I told him he was really brave. He heard I was doing the presentation. He says, "I'm coming to see it." I says, "It's on gay literature, and he's here anyway." So, Bill, good to have you here, and I hope you have a great mission. Where are you going on your mission?
Salt Lake City.
Salt Lake City.
Your home.
I'm sorry.
I went to Idaho the other day.
I went to Idaho the other day. That's good. You know the difference between a girl from Idaho and yogurt? Yogurt has culture.
Oh.
Sorry.
There are Idahoans
here. And we love them. And we love them. Anyhow, I'd like to thank up front the people that helped me collect this bibliography, but I want to tell you just a little about it. A few years ago, I was contacted by a major university to contribute an essay to an anthology that would examine how the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is depicted in popular culture. One chapter would look at television, another movies, another science fiction, and so on. The editor explained that they'd been unable to find anyone in Utah who was willing to tackle how the LDS Church was depicted in gay literature. And living in the East, I didn't have anything to lose professionally, and fools rush in where angels fear to go, so I agreed to tackle the project. And I didn't think it would take too long. I'm in theater, I knew the theater, the drama that was there, and I thought, well, how much can there be? I knew of the two Pulitzer Prize-winning works, Drury's Advice and Consent, which has a gay Mormon character, Kushner's Angels in America, and I'd read a few stories published in Mormon journals. So I did a literature search, which was augmented by contacting a few friends and by posting announcements on some internet bulletin boards, such as Q Saints Affirmation website, Gamma Fights, and so forth. And a few people came forward and really helped find works. And I'd like to thank Millie Watts and Family Fellowship as being very significant in helping find authors and works, and also James Kent, who has the Ohana News, if any of you get on that list, for helping to find authors and news. But word just kind of got out in the gay literature studies as well, and so a lot of people I didn't know, hadn't ever heard of and such, were sending me information. So I'd really like to thank them for their help in gathering the information. it became clear that I needed more time than that, which was allotted to me by the press. So I contacted them to ask if I could have my deadline extended, and I was informed that the project had been canceled. So I had a little information, and I thought, well, I can still do an article. You know, there's Sunstone, there's dialogue. I've got enough for an article. So I contacted the editor and told him that I was taking over my chapter and taking ownership of it. And if he had any problem to get in touch with me, he never got back, so I took ownership. Soon I had enough information for two articles, then three, then a book, then perhaps a book and an anthology. A prominent Mormon writer who's a close friend advised me, don't do it. They hate us. But I discovered that they, whoever they were, really don't hate us, or at least they didn't before Proposition 8. So I continued working off and on the project, and literally have been working about 7 years on gathering materials. As I progressed, I realized I needed to narrow the field. I began with play scripts since my PhD is in dramaturgy, and I'm skilled and have published extensively in that area. I eliminated poetry because I have no idea how to write about poetry. Then I eliminated nonfiction. I also eliminated erotica. I do not consider straight erotica? Literature, so to speak. So anyhow, interestingly, there's a large body of gay Mormon pornography that seems to cater to those who see Mormon missionaries as objects of their affection. I did not dabble deeply into that. I decided to focus on narrative fiction, which fit into drama and gave me a workable body of literature on which to concentrate. In the end, I decided to include every play, movie, novel, and short story that included any kind of gay Mormon theme or comment, and or any work that contains a gay Mormon character. So those are the parameters of my work. I determined that I would limit my study to narrative fiction that had actually been published in print form. If something was in print, at least one editor had agreed that the work was worthy of publication. With drama, I decided to include any script that had received at least one production by a professional theater or a university theater department directed by a faculty member. So I did not consider student productions. Or a production included in a legitimate theater festival. Films, I determined, must have an official American release, either in motion picture theaters or on a major television network. To date, I have located roughly 60 works, which dumbfounds me that I found 60 works of gay Mormon short stories, novels, drama, and films that fit these parameters. I also discovered a peripheral literature, such as John Ware's Six Degrees of Separation, which has a clear gay Mormon character, but he's never identified in the work as a gay Mormon character. So it's excluded from the study, even though it would obviously fit if John Ware had just said, well, he's Utah, and he's married, and he's gay, and he's having troubles, but he never says the word Mormon in the script. I also did not include work written by self-identified gay Mormon writers such as Ruth Knudsen, Pat Califia, or M. Shane Bell, unless their work was specifically met the parameters of the study. So there are a lot of self-identified gay Mormon writers whose work is not included, because it does not fit that. Recently, self-publishing has become so popular, so easy, and the product is so good that I have considered some self-published works, and I've determined that two were of quality strong enough to include in the work, including one by Jeff Lager, who's sitting here in the audience. So I was very pleased to be able to include his work and give it some attention. I had to find a way to organize the material that was piling up on my desk. I found a model in Woods, A History of Gay Literature, The Male Tradition. briefly stated, he recommends that studies of gay literature should follow the long-established tradition in gay literature of creating lists. This tradition began as stories passed from hand to hand. Those of you who are into gay literature know that that's the title of David Levitt's fine collection of early works, and continues as interested readers locate works, the titles of which they can then share in various locations on the internet. Wood describes how common themes emerging then can be examined as they're recognized. The Gay Mormon Literature Project will constitute a valuable contribution to both gay scholarship and Mormon scholarship, as well as provide a foundation on which scholars can pursue their own research. This consists of a complete bibliography, which is up to date. That would be so boring to read a bibliography to you, so there are copies of it available, and my email address is all over everything up here. For those people who are only listening to the CD of this, my email address is gsanla@rit.edu, and you can contact me, and I'll be happy to send you copies of this if you don't happen to get one here today, or if you're only listening to the report. So, let's move on with the bibliography. There are 15 entries, a few highlights. First of all, while I've attempted to locate every conceivable work that fits the parameters of this study, I'm not so naive as to assume that other works do not exist. If any of you know of any work which should be included, please forward bibliographic information to me at the stated email address. Please do. I really want it to be as complete as possible. Interesting thing, the first literary work which included a gay Mormon character was Advice and Consent, a Pulitzer Prize winning novel. Interestingly, it was published in 1959. The entire 700-page novel hinges on the fact that the character Brigham Anderson is gay and Mormon, and the word homosexual or gay never appears in the novel. It still was truly the sin that dare not speak its name. Absolutely. That was 1959. Another Pulitzer Prize winner and Tony winner is Angels in America. Most recently, a really interesting work is David Ebersol's The 19th Wife, which I'll talk about in just a few minutes. Other favorites include, the most recent work, which is Devin Mark Height's play, Sense of Psychopathia Sexualis, which I was just able to see in New York City 3 weeks ago. It was at the Fresh Fruit Festival. Interesting. Neil LaBute has written a work called A Gaggle of Saints in its published version. It was also published in Sunstone under the title Betch. David Levitt has produced my favorite of all of these 60 works. It's called The Term Paper Artist. It's in a collection of novellas called Arkansas. Carolyn Pearson, of course, one of our most prominent articles and gay rights enthusiasts, has written a play called Facing East, which fits. The very first Mormon work to be published was by Levi S. Peterson, and also his work, The Backslider, which I noticed last night I left off the list. So pencil in The Backslider, because it is the only instance of Mormon literature that has a transgendered character, which is really important, especially in the fact that his community, his ward, his friends embrace him, love him, help him, even when he insists on wearing a dress and asks them to call him Alice. Johnny Thompson, right here, is the most prolific author, having had 15 or 25% of the list of the works published. So that's a general overview of some of my favorite highlights. I also include the works in chronological order because I have found that to be very helpful in my research. I've also separated the works by non-Mormon writers, of which there are 16 works, and Mormon writers, of which there are 41 works. to help in your research. There are 10 novels, 29 short stories, 16 plays, and 4 films. Of all these works, six were written by women writers. Only 4 address lesbian issues. Of those 4, 3 of them were produced in the last 12 months. So there's only, until the last 12 months, there was only 1 example of lesbian fiction in Mormon fiction. So that's rather astounding that 3 works have come forth in the last few months. Now, observations and emerging themes. And this is what you came to hear. You needed to hear all that other stuff, but this is what you came to hear. These are just observations where the work is going. The first Mormon written piece, Peterson's Trinity, Levi Peterson's Trinity, appeared 23 years after the first non-Mormon work, Advising Consent. It appeared in 1982, Trinity did. But it almost did not happen. Richard Craycroft, an English professor at BYU, recommended against including it in Trinity, in Canyons of Grace, because, and I quote, "homosexuality is not a problem in the Mormon Church." I guess he knows he teaches at BYU. 13 of the works were generated since September 2008. That means almost 25% of the works were generated in the last 1 year. So we're seeing a blossoming and a mushrooming of literary works being made available, which is rather astounding. Only 4 works, Not Quite Peru, which is the first lesbian piece published, The Hands of Sodom, Execute This, Confessions of a Mormon Freak, and our own Melissa Larson's Happy Little Secrets, Examine the Lesbian Mormon Experience. 3 of these were published or produced in the last 12 months. Several of the works have received major awards. 2 are Pulitzer Prize winners, Advising Consent and Angels in America. Advising Consent, the film, won the National Board of Review Award. Angel in America in New York won 2 Tony Awards. On television, it won 5 Golden Globes and 27 additional major awards. Dancing Naked by Dan Wagner won the Utah Novel of the Year. Lasting Impressions won the first place in the Sexuality in the New Millennium, a short story competition sponsored by Sensations Literary Journal. And Confessions of a Mormon Boy won the New York City Fringe Festival Audience Favorite Award. So this isn't just trivial stuff. Major award-winning fiction and drama is included, and film is included in this work. I already mentioned that Johnny's the most prolific of the writers, with 15 short stories published in 7 different journals, everything from the Harrington Gay Men's Literature Review to Dialogue and Sunstone. He writes extensively on the struggling gay missionary, as well as on the concerns of family members of gay Mormons. This gets long, this next section. Early works written by non-Mormons featured gay Mormon characters delineated only by pop culture type. Brigham Anderson, for example, in Advising Consent, filled the role of a highly respected, completely moral, family man senator in Drury's work. He was identified as Mormon, and much was made of his unblemished Utah background. However, the details of his life are exclusively Catholic. His brother served in the priesthood while he went into public service. He drank, swore, and had clearly never seen the inside of a Mormon temple. Strangers on Earth in 1993, another Broadway play, featured a young man newly arrived in New York City from Utah who was also Mormon in name only. All the while, he was described in terms that better suited a Southern Baptist, such as his penchant for singing Protestant Bible songs. Details of the church clearly came solely from a 1988 New York Times article on the Hill Cumorah pageant. Beginning in 1993, there's a complete change in non-Mormon writing, though, with Tony Kushner's Angels in America. A new respect for getting Mormonism right emerges. Since then, every work by a non-Mormon writer has been reasonably well researched and pays careful attention to the culture of what it means to be Mormon. Two interesting themes have more recently developed in non-Mormon fiction. Responses to encounters with gay Mormons and Mormons being included in stories because we have become a recognized part of mainstream American culture. For example, in Rebkin's The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told, it includes a BYU interning in New York City, attempting to get along with gay colleagues. Some of the dialogue. Why do you always pick on Mormons? This is New York. Mormons are our Jews. I love that. From Angels in America. This is my ex-lover's Mormon mother. Even in New York in the 80s, that is strange. So, we're being looked at. Hunters and Gatherers, a short story, describes the surreal encounter of a California gay man who meets a married gay Mormon who is clearly trying to follow the program outlined by Evergreen, which is the Mormon version of Exodus that believes homosexuals can be reoriented. He is totally puzzled by what happens. In the summer, my cousin turned Mormon. A gay teen is perplexed when he discovers his recently converted Mormon cousin is trying to follow Mark E. Peterson's pamphlet on overcoming masturbation. It becomes a sex pamphlet. So far as assimilating into the general culture, how long has this been going on? 1995 is a panoramic study, a panoramic story. Thank you. Told against the backdrop of changing American gay culture from the 1950s through the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s. Its characters are all prototypic gay types and includes a Mormon from Salt Lake City. Very interestingly, the 19th wife, which pairs a fundamentalist LDS gay man with an excommunicated gay Mormon as they attempt to solve a murder in a fictitious polygamous Southern Utah community. Both the FLDS and LDS men are depicted accurately and are integrated into the novel so well that's what's usually seen as a double plot about the murder, modern murder, and Brigham Young's 19th wife, ergo the name 19th wife. It totally overlooks the fact that there's a third major plot line involving the two gay Mormon characters. That's really interesting. So in conclusion, this writing has progressed from Mormons in name only to well-researched Mormon culture, doctrine, and characters. Surreal encounters with gay Mormon characters and Mormons who have entered the mainstream of American culture. I've only got a couple of minutes left, so I'll hurry through the last couple. 15 stories concern the coming out process. There are many stories that present the family drama, such as Dancing Naked, The Buzzard Tree, I Love You No Matter What, No Looking Back. Suicide committed by gay Mormons is explored in Dancing Naked, Facing East meets the Solemnist, the play about Henry, and Sense Psychopathia Sexualis. We seem to love Latin titles. This is significant. Bitterness against the church comes forward in only gay Mormon written pieces. And it's expressed, the bitterness is directed against the church's failed policies toward homosexuals. A play called 14 examines the BYU electroshock therapy program that's fully documented, yet completely officially denied. Confessions of a Mormon Boy, Hands of Sodom, all depict real bitterness against the author's experiences with the church. And finally, several works respond specifically to statements made by general authorities and other church leaders. The most prevalent theme in this is the attempt to reconcile what's been spoken from the pulpit as truth with the dissonance it causes in the lives of gay Mormons. Lasting Impressions responds to the promise that if you go on a mission and marry in the temple, you will be cured of your homosexuality. Singer simply states, back when I believed the lie. The conflict of Heights and Psychopathia Sexualis explores the dissonance created when a young man absolutely believes what he's told by church leaders and how it prevents him from interpreting what's actually happening in his life. How does one interpret one's sexuality when he believes the false notion that homosexuality only exists when it's manifest in sexual relations? How can one accept a core part of his being when he is taught that that core does not exist? Stephen Dales exclaims, I am not an adjective. Other statements that are referred to are by Boyd Packer, Spencer Kimball, Mark Peterson, Dallin Oaks, Gordon Hinckley, Merrill Bateman, Ernest Wilkinson. In conclusion, the work of gathering and sorting is coming to an end. Emerging themes have been identified. Thorough examinations have been outlined in all of the areas just described. Other articles are also in development, including the development of gay Mormon drama, the gay Mormon in the cinema, homophobia and harassment, the proclamation on the family, and gay Mormons and a separate examination of the impact of the fiction and critical writings of Orson Scott Card on gay Mormon writing. Now that the bibliography has been made public, which is why I'm here, other scholars are invited to become involved and continue the journey that has begun.
Hello. As Paul mentioned, my name is Melissa Leila Larson. I'm a playwright from Provo. My friends call me Mel. I work in the theater arts department at Utah Valley University, where I will be starting a lectureship teaching theater history and dramatic writing this fall. And I attend the Provo Edgewood Ward, where over the past year I've tried not to be too cynical while spending Sunday afternoons with 6 and 7 year olds. It's hard to know what makes you more cynical. It's spending Sundays with the 6 and 7 year olds or spending Monday, Wednesday, Fridays with the 19 year olds who think they know everything about theater. So anyway, it's been my pleasure and honor to be with you today to discuss with you a little bit a play I wrote. Is that me? Am I causing feedback? Oh goodness. It's entitled Little Happy Secrets, and it's the story of a... It is me. Goodness. Thank you.
Just changing the angle.
Sorry, I'm too tall. I apologize.
You're too electrified.
Oh, now I'm blushing. Right. But the play is the story of Claire, who is a young woman recently returned from a mission in Germany, who comes back to BYU, meets up with her best friend from who's also been serving a mission. And they are roommates, and she's pursuing her degree in English. And she comes to question whether or not the feelings that she has for her best friend are feelings of friendship, or feelings of affection, or feelings of love. And that's... sexual experimentation at BYU is different than it is at any other university anywhere else in the world. And so, well, no, they don't talk about it, but it does happen.
No.
And there's some really interesting. I found from my personal experience that there's some really interesting. How shall I say? The culture, the way that that women treat each other in the culture at BYU is just different than it is anywhere else. With my good friends, when I'm living in Provo, there's a lot of hugging, there's a lot of hand-holding, there's if you watch a movie with your best girlfriends, it's not uncommon for someone to fall asleep and put her head in someone else's lap. It's just very... And maybe this is just me and my friends, but we were just very, very touchy-feely. When I went to Iowa to pursue my master's degree, that kind of touchy-feely was associated with sexual experimentation, with young women of a college age who were trying to decide whether they were straight or whether they were gay, or if they were gay for 2 weeks and then straight for 2 weeks, or, you know, there was a lot of switching it up. And so what I had initially felt was affection and just honest friendship was perceived by another set of friends as an expression of sexuality, which I had never even conceived before. Maybe I was, I don't know, innocent to a degree, or maybe I just was thinking about love being something other than, you know, hand-holding while watching a movie in a shaggy apartment. That's kind of the core issue that started the writing of Little Happy Secrets. It is a love story, an unrequited love story, at the same time that it's an exploration of the question of am I not, is this something I'm putting on myself, which could be applied to anyone, straight or gay, I hope. Because Claire, as a person, is just at that point in her life where she's asking herself a lot of personal questions. She's trying to figure things out, where she wants to be, what she wants to do. I'd like to share with you a quote from the play, from a monologue that she has fairly late on. After she is, she's actually left BYU and is living with her sister in Seattle. And her sister's just recently lost a baby to SIDS. My sister and I have always been good at giving each other space. She did her thing, and I did mine, but now we had both endured a heartbreak, and that changed the air between us. Leveled the playing field? I don't know. We had something in common, something we hadn't before. We had each understood the other's sorrow, and then suddenly the incongruities in taste and personality all seemed superficial. After all, we both want what everyone wants, that elusive happy ending. What I've realized, though, is that a happy ending, that's a bit of a tall order for every day. I mean, ultimately, sure, you want to end happily, but at the same time, who wants to end? Either you're happy and ended, or you're not quite happy, but at least still living. It's a literal take, I know, but that's where I have to find consolation, in the fact that I'm still living, day to day, hour to hour, breath to breath, just living. Now, Claire does come to a point where she contemplates suicide, but she chooses to not go through with it. She also chooses to stay a member of the church. The object of her affection. The way I've structured the play, the girl that Claire is in love with, her name is Brennan, could be played a number of ways. My hope is that in different productions, those different avenues can be explored. One of those is that she returns Claire's affection. One of those is that she's completely unaware of it. And another is that she is aware of it, but fights against it. And I think that there are a number of different ways that that Claire's story could be taken. For me, it's become very personal. I'm going to I've made a term up, and it's a little silly, but it seems to be the most fitting. I feel that the process of writing this play has it's become a speculative autobiography, and what I mean by that is that I am not gay. But there was a time in my life when I thought I was. I am 33 and single in the church, and that is A-okay. I am perfectly happy where I am. I am too busy for boys, and that's okay. I have a lot to do, and I don't know, maybe the one feeds the other, I'm not sure. But I've been told by older and middle-aged men that I'm beautiful, that if I were single and 20 years younger, you know, look out. I've been told by men my age that I'm cool and that I'm easy to talk to, and that it's funny that a girl would have an Xbox. My response is, well, what about a girl who has an Xbox and a PlayStation 3? And then they just look at me. So that is the extent of my dating life, and for the most part, I'm okay with the fact that I'm single and about to turn 33. But in the spring and summer of 2002, I was about to turn 26, and I was unmarried, and I thought that something was wrong with me. And I was trying to figure that out. The most amazing and life-affirming experiences I was having at the time were in creating theater, in writing and producing plays, and making short films, and all of those experiences involved women. So I asked myself the question, am I meant to be with a woman rather than a man? I asked myself and I asked God. Now, I discovered the answer, no. I discovered Daniel Craig is indeed. And I'm okay with that, you know. But the seed was planted for this story, for Claire's story. And so in writing it, which didn't happen until a special topics class at Iowa, my third year in the spring of 2007, I was able to look at my experience. I was able to separate myself from it 5 years later and guess at what my story would be if I had been gay, if I had, you know, chosen to live my life differently than I did. And there's no fault in either of those choices. I just chose differently than Claire does. Her story is not mine. Her story is what mine could be. I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody. But for me as a writer, what I usually try to do is really inhabit a character. I try to really walk around as them as much as possible, try to figure out what they are, who they are. And when it comes to making choices, I feel, as a character, I feel that I'm making those choices. And I try to make that situation my own. So the way that I look at Claire, her struggle and her questions, that the way she chooses to share things and the way that her story chooses to share itself, the way it chose to share itself with me, I'm looking at how I might respond to those situations as if I were, in fact, her. The fact that there are two women at the core of this story, Claire and Brennan, has brought up questions from audience members. We did a production in Provo this past March because I was feeling a little, I don't know, socially suicidal, I guess. We had talkback sessions following each performance. It seemed that there were two questions I could always expect. Is this play autobiographical? Because how could you write something so personal if it's not autobiographical? Okay, those are two questions, but they go together, so it doesn't count. Without fail, there was also always a man who would make a comment very similar to this. I don't know if I can relate to the story because it happens to two girls. I would be lying to say if I don't write women better than I write men. The reason being that I'm a woman. Hey, look at that. I have a personal goal to have at least 2 to 3 strong female characters in every piece I write, regardless of whether or not the protagonist is a woman or a man. I don't think I could have told this particular story as honestly or as completely if Claire had been a Robert or a Chad or a Jeff. I'd like to leave that to a Robert or a Chad or a Jeff. By the same token, I think, or at least I hope, that the unique specificity of the fact that this is a love story that revolves around two women actually makes the story more universal. There are certain stereotypes, I think, that have been set by our culture, both by our American culture and nested within it our LDS mindset, that would make this story very difficult not only for me to tell, but for an LDS audience to accept if the characters were male. However, unconsciously, the majority of a Provo audience would think certain things right off the bat as soon as they understood that a male character is gay. With Claire, I had a bit of a cushion. The audience didn't know what to expect. She doesn't fit any particular stereotype other than the bookish English major or the quietly contemplative returned missionary. Maybe she's the roommate who seems a little weird, but that's just because no one knows her terribly well. Except, well, I do, I guess. Every audience member, regardless of their background, comes to a play with some preconceived notion of who the characters are and what they should be doing. That's what stereotypes are. Types and cliches. The thing is that at the same time we talk about avoiding them, types and cliches, in our writing, sometimes they are the figures in a story audience members latch onto first and tightest, and you can't quite shake that grip. My hope with Claire is that if she is a type, she is the most invisible kind, the type that one might relate to without even realizing it, which is why I think I was able to connect to her so easily myself, because I saw so much of myself in her. We live in a judgmental society. I'm a judgmental person. I actually wrote that in my program note for the production in March. This is what I wrote in the program. For me, being judgmental is the easiest sin to commit, and therefore the hardest to overcome. It's so easy for me to meet someone, to hear a voice over the phone at work, or brush up against someone in the aisles of Target, and put them in a box. In mere seconds, and totally without thinking, I have determined that person's worth in my life, measuring them against my own ridiculous scale. Naturally, there is much, much more to each person we know or meet, or even simply pass in traffic. The thing is, our personal scales of worth are, well, worthless to anyone but ourselves. I think, for me personally, the writing of this play, the exploration of this character, has helped me to take steps toward overcoming my problem with judging others. I think it has helped me to really explore what honesty is in the theater. Sometimes we talk in very broad terms about character and about, you know, relating to them, and I just really feel that's something that I've taken for granted up until this point. I've written a lot of big, huge, pageant-like historical epics that don't really have a lot going on in them as far as character. You know, a lot of costume changes, a lot of dialect work, a lot of big, scary battle scenes that no one wants to produce because they cost a lot of money. And with this play, it's kind of, the coin is kind of flipped, and it's very small, it's very intimate, the cast is only 4 people. It could be done very easily in the living room, and actually that would be an interesting experience. I was determined to write a simple contemporary story, and Claire's story came out in less than a weekend. It just started. I didn't think about it. It came out fully formed. And I kind of think that someone else was pushing the pen for me. I don't know if I had stayed in Provo at the time that I wrote the play, if it would have been written. I don't think it would have. Everything would have been too close. I needed the distance. I joke sometimes that I met Claire in a green vinyl booth in Burger Supreme in Provo. And Burger Supreme takes their scene in Burger Supreme in the play. I have a distinct feeling that she sat me down and told me her story, and I had to write it down really quickly before I forgot it. But I'm really thankful for the time that I had in Iowa. Because I needed the distance, both of time and place, to discover this story and to guess at what my own might be. I still am guessing. The play is available as a podcast. For those of you who are interested, it's a free podcast in the iTunes store. So you just search for Little Happy Secrets, or you can search for me. My name, Melissa Leilani Larson, in the iTunes store, and it's available as a free podcast. I would also be willing to send the script out in email form to anyone who would like to read it. But thank you very much for your time.
Most of my gay published stories deal with my 2 years as a missionary in Italy. I actually wrote many of the stories before I came out with a straight main character, and my writing professor and my workshop classmates were mildly interested in the stories, but they didn't really gain whatever power they might have until I rewrote them with a gay main character. The problem with a lot of Mormon writing is that writers are trying to prove some doctrinal point. The stories are vehicles for proselytizing in one form or another. in that sense, they're very much like former Soviet art that is really just propaganda. Mormon literature can never be a mature art form, so we focus on the humanity of our position, not on our chosen status. Most of my gay characters, certainly the gay missionaries, are completely dedicated to the church. But I'm not trying to prove that the church is true, despite our terrible doubts and failings. Conversely, I'm not trying to prove that the church isn't true or that it is an evil organization. The truthfulness of the church or the lack thereof can't be a relevant topic if our literature is going to be valuable. What I'm trying to do is show the horrible plight that even good people with the best of intentions can find themselves in if they don't fit the cookie-cutter mold they're supposed to fit in. I don't believe only mainstream Mormons are worth writing about, which is what I heard one prominent LDS writer say once. I find that attitude thoroughly appalling. I am not mainstream, and I believe I am still a full human being completely worthy of notice. My father is a high priest on the stake high council for years, and he is married to his fourth wife. Not mainstream of him. My aunt was Relief Society president, all the while married to a gay man. My cousin is married to a returned missionary in the temple, and she adopted because she couldn't bear children. We are all non-mainstream, and all of us have stories worth telling, and more importantly, worth hearing. The strength of Mormonism is its sameness everywhere, but that is also its weakness. We need to embrace diversity within our own walls, and writing of gay and lesbian Mormons is one way to do this. People have read some of my stories and said, Mormons wouldn't do that. I'm not writing about Mormons as a whole. I'm writing about this individual Mormon or that individual. And those possibilities, individual people might do anything, and those possibilities should be explored. We can't write only about generic Mormons. We have to write about the complex characters that really exist without having the agenda that we need to put on a good appearance. Mormonism needs to be the background, something that informs the story, not the point of the story. We can't worry about whether this is a faith-promoting story or one that might shake someone's faith. People's belief systems have to be strong enough to read about people who do or think things that are unorthodox. If their faith isn't strong enough to take it, that is their problem, not mine. I can't tailor my stories that only weak people can handle them. A Mormon editor once told me that he liked a particular story of mine, a straight story, by the way, but he couldn't publish it because it contained the word penis. Vulgarity is one thing, but maturity is another. We need to be able to deal with mature topics if we ever want to have a mature literature. We can't be worried if something is challenging or offensive or argumentative, as long as it is relevant and relates to the LDS experience. There are Jewish books and magazines with stories critical of Israeli policies or Jewish practices. There are gay magazines with writing critical of gay attitudes and behaviors. Until we as Mormons can handle opposition in our own discussion amongst ourselves, we will be relegated to articles and stories that are nothing more meaningful than the preacher preaching to the choir. In the same manner, it can't be my goal as a gay Mormon writer to go out and convince Mormon readers that gays are really all right and the church should change its policies and doctrines to accommodate us. That then becomes proselytizing as well. I certainly try to move my readers, and if moving them means the readers feel favorably toward gays, I think that is a good thing. But I have gay characters make unwise choices, do wrong things that aren't necessarily praiseworthy. Some of my characters are admirable, and some make big mistakes. I would say one thing I do try to show is that oppression of gays is misguided, that torturing us is not a good or righteous act. In my story, The 920 Express Train to Hell, I show how the church drives good people to suicide and how creating this misery can't possibly be acceptable to God. In The Sneakover Prince, I use the analogy of doing proxy work in the temple to show how gays are forced by the church to live their entire lives by proxy, by never being allowed to marry the people they love. In my story, Pissing in Peace, I show how the church can be invasive to unnatural extremes, exemplified by choosing even our underwear, but also by its audacity in telling us who can allow ourselves to love. In Bus Surfing, I demonstrate that same-sex affection in other cultures can be perfectly acceptable, even among Mormons, and throw into question the predominant American attitude which currently directs the church. In Mormon Underwear, I discuss the possibility of polyandry among gay men. Basically, I try to raise particularly Mormon issues in my stories, are just universal human beings using Mormonism as a foundation. I show monogamous gays in my stories and promiscuous ones, gays who are good, decent people and gays who are not. All my gay characters can't be model citizens. They have to be real to have any meaning. Gays complained about the villain in the movie The Silence of the Lambs, saying it showed gays in a bad light. But did you see any heterosexuals boycott in the movie because Hannibal Lecter was straight? We don't want to only be villains, our wacky neighbors, or any other single thing. We have to show gays as heroes, as villains, as everything in between, just the way heterosexuals are portrayed. I don't claim to be Isaac Bashevis, a singer, but I do think he's a good model for us. He writes Jewish stories that don't proclaim Judaism as true religion. He simply tells human stories from a Jewish perspective, well enough to win a Nobel Prize for literature. We can write great literature, too, by using our Mormonism to give color to our stories, to give specificity to our stories. We need to tell the universal to the particular. In Dual Diagnosis, one of my gay Mormon characters has to attend AA meetings designed for those having trouble with mental illness in addition to alcoholism. In Healing the Sick, I had my gay married couple bicker about universal health care. In The Mark of Abel, my gay main character tries to overcome his racial prejudices. I don't think every gay Mormon story has to be about homosexuality. But I think homosexuality, unfortunately, can't help but be a major issue in most of our stories, and that's too bad. The rest of gay literature has moved on to a post-gay phase, where it's simply a given that the character is gay, and it is not at all the focus of the story. We need more of that in our literature, too. But I still write stories, like Splitting with Elder Tanner, where my gay returned missionary decides to serve a second full-time mission because having a missionary companion is the closest he can get to morally marrying another man. As gays and lesbians with some understanding of the craft of storytelling, we need to make ourselves seen and heard and understood. Mainstream Mormons wish we didn't exist. They wish we would just go away and leave them alone. We need to write gay stories so that we make ourselves visible, make ourselves noticed, so that no one can forget we are here and that we must be acknowledged. I would say, though, that I write more non-gay Mormon stories than gay ones. In all of my stories, however, my main goal has to be simply to tell a good story, something that makes the reader feel more alive, more human, more compassionate for having read it. I think there are millions of Mormon stories to tell. Unfortunately, however, as writers of gay stories, what we too often find lacking is room for our stories in the world of Mormon publishing. When I submit a story to Sunstone or Dialogue or Irantum, I have to worry not only about my writing skill, but also if I'm being too brazen and shocking. If a heterosexual couple kisses, it's sweet. But if a gay couple does it, it seems a militant action of shoving their perverted lifestyle in other people's faces. I've had 3 gay Mormon stories turned down by Mormon editors, which were then all published by non-Mormon publishers. I can't help but believe my stories were rejected by Mormon editors solely for their gay content and not for any literary considerations. Hopefully that is changing a little, but we have to publish wherever we can, even if that limits our Mormon audience. A lot of my stories are based on real experiences. As most writers do, I take real incidents and adapt them to the story. But only one of my stories is based on a historical event completely outside of my own experience. On Gay Pride Day in 1973, an arsonist set fire to a gay bar in New Orleans. A gay Mormon was one of the survivors, but his partner was one of 32 people who died that terrible day. My research on the event is in the historic New Orleans collection in the French Quarter, and it's being used by a historian to write a much overdue book on the subject. But I decided to try to use my fiction skills to make a dramatic approach to the fire. I'm going to read an excerpt now from my story, Burning Love. I didn't drink, of course. That would have been a sin. But I liked the crowd on Sundays. A large group from the Metropolitan Community Church came. I talked to the minister, Bill Larson, every Sunday. He always assured me that God loved gays, but I was never quite convinced. Mormons didn't believe in a literal furnace for hell. No hellfire, just damnation. Pastor Bill was irritated that I wouldn't join his congregation, where people loved each other rather than just judged each other. The religious used to burn gays alive in the Middle Ages, he said. It's not so terribly different even now. You need to escape before your spirit itself is burned to a crisp. He really said this around 7 o'clock that Sunday night. I remember stupidly joking in reply, "Well, I feel a burning now when I pee." I was excommunicated a week later while I was still in the hospital. Bill's family wouldn't even claim his body. A lot of those killed at the upstairs were never claimed, their families too embarrassed to admit they were related to gays, and many churches adamantly refused to bury the dead. Three victims were never even identified, but even those of survivors of the MCC weren't allowed to bury because they had no legal claim to the bodies. They were buried in a potter's field at the end of Canal Street. It all began innocently enough. I was near the piano. We were all holding hands and singing United We Stand. Buddy was working the bar, and despite all the noise all around us, we could still hear the door buzzer ringing over and over. It was becoming annoying. Sometimes cab drivers would buzz, but this was clearly someone just trying to be a pest. I saw Buddy motion for Luther to go answer the door at the top of the stairs. I was only casually watching Luther, still singing along, but was distracted when I felt a hand on my ass. I turned to look at the guy sitting next to me, and he gave me an impish smile. Pastor Bill was just a few feet away, singing along with Mitch and Horace, a couple of his congregants. Almost half the church group came to the upstairs on Sundays after services. They were, in fact, pretty decent people, but I couldn't bring myself to leave the Mormons just yet. I was irritated that we didn't allow blacks to hold the priesthood, but I was sure it was only a matter of time. The church would clearly accept gays one day, too. It was a true church, after all. I loved it, so they had to. I heard a scream, and the piano stopped. I looked over to the entrance of the bar and saw Luther, his shirt on fire, flames pushing to the door at the top of the stairs. We all watched in shock as he shoved a woman right into the door leading to the fire escape, shattering the glass with her face. Then we all realized at the same moment that even now, that one lone fire escape was completely blocked by flames. Everyone started screaming and yelling and fumbling for the windows behind the piano. There were three floor-to-ceiling windows, but the weighted ropes had rotted. Every time we pulled the window up, it would slide back down like a guillotine. I heard more screams, pain, not terror. I looked behind me. Two people were coming out of the bathroom near the fire escape, were burning. The carpet on the floor leading to our area lifted right off the floor as the flames spread across the room in seconds. The Burt Reynolds poster was burning. The Mark Spitz poster was gone. The ceiling tiles were on fire. It was all so quick. "Hurry, damn it," I shouted, pushing a man in front of me. He fell to the street on top of somebody already there. Oh my God, the heat was unbearable. I clawed at the window frame. People were pushing me ahead and pulling me back to take my place. The crowd behind me were screaming and yelling. I crouched down and put one leg over the ledge and heard more screams. I was the last person to make it out of my window. When I hit the street, I twisted my ankle and some passersby ran over to help beat out the flames on my shirt. Lying in the street, I could see Bill Larson trying to get out his window. It kept sliding down him. He finally stopped trying to lift it. He punched one hole through the glass with one hand and another hole with the other. He struggled to pull himself through the broken window. His cut arms were bleeding. His back was on fire. His hair was on fire. "Oh, God, no," he screamed. He twisted and turned as he lay burning halfway out the window. The men behind him were still screaming, all being burned alive. I saw Buddy on the street next to me looking up in horror. I could see his lover, Adam, still sitting on the stool at the end of the bar, his arms waving in the air as he burned. There are people even now who would like to see us burn, who would gladly wipe us completely out of existence. We have to be witnesses of the oppression we still face, oppression that comes mostly from so-called righteous people. But we have to write about the joy and love we experience as well. I'm a gay Mormon. I'm married to a gay Mormon. And despite what the rest of the Mormons think of us, we still lead very happy lives. You need conflict to have a strong story, but we can include good things in our writing, too. Every writing teacher says, write what you know. What we know is the gay Mormon experience. And more specifically, we can move beyond our individual history, of course, and write anything we want. But we are most likely to write something truly worth reading if we focus on what we know best. There will always be gay Mormons, so there will always be worthwhile gay Mormon stories to tell.
think I hate you, Johnny. I don't want to follow that. And I'm also kicking myself for not having included a sample of my own novel to write. I don't know what I was... I don't know what I was thinking. I guess we'll just have to wait for it all to... all of you wait for it to come out. So to speak. I'm Jonathan Langford. I'm the author of No Going Back, which is a coming-of-age novel about a gay Mormon teen. That's due out from Zarahemla Books in a month or two. The publisher's best guess at present is the end of September or beginning of October. We'd hope to have copies by now, but you know, real life interferes with the hobby that publishing in the Mormon sphere generally is. A money-losing hobby in many cases. So... there's some flyers with information about the book on the chair at the end of the aisle. I imagine a lot of you picked it up already. And the title that I chose for my remarks today, back when Jerry told me that I needed a title, was Writing the Great Gay Teen Mormon Novel, with a question mark after it. The question mark's important. The title's at least somewhat ironic, since I really don't think my book is the great gay teen Mormon novel. Though so far as I know, it is the first novel about, list the condition, a gay teen who happens to be Mormon, that focuses on the Mormon context, and is aimed at a mainstream Mormon readership. You're the one who knows, but I think once I include all those qualifiers, it is the first of them. That fits all that.
And most doesn't kill himself.
And he doesn't kill himself. That's true. Yes, I though. Yeah, I didn't want to write. I'm not saying. Never mind. Anyway, he doesn't kill himself. Most of what I'm talking about today is some of how I came to write that novel. Together with my thoughts about gay Mormon literature in general, to the extent that I'm aware of it. I haven't read nearly as widely as, well, certainly not as Jerry. I think he now qualifies as the world expert on this. How my novel fits into what I know and think about that developing category, including the people I hope will read it, and what my hopes would be for what it might accomplish. And the story starts about 8 years ago, if memory serves me correctly, in a discussion touching on gay Mormon literature on AML list, which is the email discussion list sponsored by the Association for Mormon Letters. As I recall, the conversation was sparked by comments from Rex Good, one of the relatively small number of active LDS men who is also, in his case, married, who is also publicly out as same-sex attracted. I've forgotten the precise literary tie-in, but I do recall Rex's observations about the situation of those like himself who are same-sex attracted or gay or whatever term you prefer to use, and I'll probably be waltzing among the different terms as I read this here, perhaps with important significance and perhaps not, but also committed to living by LDS church standards, which... you require that you not, as currently articulated, require that you not enter into any kind of same-sex romantic or sexual relationship. In Rex's experience, such individuals tended not to receive much sympathy and understanding in either the gay community or the LDS community. Among fellow church members, typical reactions include incomprehension and discomfort, at times extending to accusations of unworthiness and perversion. Among gays, typical reactions, as he characterized them, include incomprehension and a kind of condescending pity. At times extending to hostility and accusations of hypocrisy and self-directed homophobia. In literature as in life, as Rex described it, there was a general sense that you could be gay or Mormon, but not both, at least not in the long term. Further discussion revealed that none of us on the AML list at that time could think of examples within Mormon fiction
of someone who was struggling with same-sex attraction while staying in the church. Keep in mind, this was 8 years ago. As opposed to stories about people in that situation who seemed headed out of the church. I have to quickly caution that just because we didn't know of any such stories, it didn't necessarily mean that such stories didn't exist. Even so, it certainly doesn't seem to have been a prominent strand in gay Mormon fiction, with a few noteworthy examples, such as Mel Larson's, Melissa Larson's play, and which I had the, which is a fine play which I've had the opportunity to read, though not sadly to see performed. This absence seems telling. At least equally striking is the almost complete absence of homosexuality in fiction aimed at the general Mormon market. And when I say almost complete absence, well, it's my understanding that there are Mormon young adult novels dealing with a variety of challenging topics, ranging from substance abuse to abusive home situations and handicaps. But no one I've spoken to can name a character in a Mormon young adult novel who's struggling with same-sex attraction, or even a scene where a character in such a novel has to deal with finding out that a friend or acquaintance is gay. And this, I don't have to tell you, is not realistic. My oldest son, now 20, grumbled to me in high school about the boy who kept hitting on him and his best friend. Another boy who'd been in classes with him since fourth grade had come out as gay by the time they both left for college. Neither of those was LDS, but nonetheless, for that matter, even back when I was a freshman at BYU, I knew several students who were homosexual, and who I knew were homosexual. Since then, I've come to know many other people who deal with this in one way or another. Friends, co-workers, members and non-members both. And even as I discovered a few years ago, my Catholic best friend from when I was when we were growing up. In short, homosexuality is part of the reality that we and our children and our friends and brothers and sisters are all dealing with, both as part of a larger society and within the church, and even in our own families. So why isn't it there in our literature? And there is, of course, as Jerry has commented, plenty of literature out there that describes, there is, of course, plenty of literature out there that describes more generically the experiences of those who are gay, including some individuals with strong religious beliefs that forbid them to act on those feelings. But there is, I would submit, more to the gay Mormon experience than that. Several years ago, I wrote the following in an article for Irriantum, describing my thoughts about the gay Mormon character in Tony Kushner's two-part play, Angels in America, which Jerry mentioned. Joe's internal anguish, his struggle to repress his homosexual feelings, and their conflict with his religious values seem well drawn to me, but also generic. They're the sort of feelings that anyone from a sexually restrictive religion might possess. But if you're Mormon, being part of a family is more than just a badge of normality. It's part of your essential purpose for existing, a key element of your eternal identity. Surely part of what makes being gay, Mormon and gay so poignant is the sense that choosing a life of homosexuality isn't just a sin. It's also giving up who you are and who you're and what you are meant to be as a child of God in the Orthodox Mormon understanding. There are elements of the gay Mormon experience that are distinctive to Mormonism. And we deserve a literature that will describe that experience. To some extent, of course, such literature already exists. The existence of this panel is obviously evidence of that. In particular, there's in addition to the focus of that Jerry described, there's also a wide range, particularly of personal essays and memoirs out there, both in print and on the internet, representing experiences both of those who have left the church and those who have stayed. I don't want to downplay the importance of such true life narratives. For one thing, they play an important role in establishing a baseline of realistic experiences for what has happened in the lives of those who are Mormon and same-sex attracted. As a writer and lover of fiction, however, it seems to me that any literature is far from fully developed that consists primarily of such real life stories. Such true life stories represent, I suppose, the literary equivalent of field notes. But we need the more controlled literary experiments of fiction as well, to demonstrate to us not only what is, but also what imaginatively can be. And such fiction narratives have been both fewer and more limited in scope. In particular, as I mentioned before, there's little to nothing describing such experiences in the literature most church members are reading, the Deseret Bookcraft Covenant stuff. In short, there are still huge gaps in what kinds of stories are being told and who they're being told to. To the extent that literature is a tool for helping us grapple with the challenging realities of life, by and large, it's a tool that hasn't been used in helping church members learn how to deal with this particular challenge, by which I mean both homosexuality itself and how we as members of the church relate to those, both inside and outside our fellowship, who struggle with that challenge, or being accepted in, or what the various varieties of that. Please note, by the way, that in talking about literature as a tool, I'm not talking about specifically didactic literature. What I'm talking about is the gift of understanding and empathy that well-written and honest narratives can provide when they open us up to experiences outside our own. But how can they do that when whole categories of experience aren't adequately represented? Which brings me to now going back. I should caution you that what I'm about to say will include some spoilers for the story. I shall pause briefly for anyone who wants to put their fingers in their ears. Now, I have to say, I'm the sort of person who I read the first chapter, I read the second chapter, I read the third chapter, and by that point I'm so anxious about what's going to happen to the main character that I flip ahead and read the last chapter. And then I read the next to the last chapter, and then I tend to work my way toward the middle from both directions. Which I've been told by people is an absolute complete crime and heresy. And when I'm reading a book to review it or something like that, I force myself not to do that so I can try to experience the book as the writer intended it to be. But but for me, knowing what's going to happen is perfectly fine. But if, you know, but for those of you, you know, who are weaker than myself in this respect, or something. Inspired by the conversation on AML list, as well as a number of thoughts that have been percolating in my head over the years, I had an idea for a short story involving two teenagers, best friends, both Mormon, one same-sex attracted and the other not. It would start with a boy who was gay coming out to his friend. Over the course of the story, he'd be publicly outed, and as a result would lose the opportunity of becoming an Eagle Scout. The story would end with his best friend sitting at the sacrament table, struggling with his anger and frustration at the way his friend had been treated by the members of his ward. The story, as I envisioned it, would focus primarily on the non-gay teenager and how he dealt with the impact of his friend's revelation on his life. But I never wrote that story. Skip forward about 6 years to a time when I was resolving, for about the 14th or 15th time, to get off my duff and actually do something with my creative writing. So I trotted out several old story ideas, including my gay teen Mormon story. You've got to understand, I plan to be a science fiction fantasy writer, and so it's kind of a surprise to me that this is the novel that came out instead. So I tried out the ideas started flowing, I thought about making the best friend's father also their bishop. I envisioned what might happen when his wife found out that her husband had known that their son's best friend was gay and hadn't told her. I started thinking about what kind of experience my gay Mormon kid might have at his high school GSA, the Gay Straight Alliance Club. And I started writing, and the book took on a life of its own, as such things do. I decided to set my story in Western Oregon, partly because it had the LDS population density I wanted, not predominantly Mormon, but with enough Mormons to constitute a distinct presence within the high school and local community. More, for example, than you find in western Wisconsin. And also because I grew up there, so it wasn't completely alien territory. Then when I was thinking about a time frame for the story, I remembered the 2004 Gay Marriage Ballot Initiative in Oregon, which I thought would make a great external source of tension in my story. This, by the way, was before I'd even heard the words Proposition 8, and I've had distinctly mixed feelings about Proposition 8 and the purely selfish connection of, you know, what's it going to do to the way my novels work? So, that's the end of the spoilers, and those of you with your fingers in your ears may now discreetly remove them. Writing the book... Okay. I need to skip ahead then. I got a lot of responses over AML list I put out for, and a Motley Vision website I put out for readers, and I got a great number of responses. I know partly because it's a kind of story that's important to a great many people. For that matter, if there are any of my reviewers who are in the audience who I've never met in person, please come up and introduce yourselves to me, and I'm very grateful for all of them. Even the ones who didn't like it. But in any event, my original point, though, was that I don't think that No Going Back, I don't consider it as being the great gay teen one novel. One of the things you sometimes hear in literary circles is that a particular book or story transcends its specific circumstances to describe universals of human nature. I'm not sure I believe in that. What I believe instead is that there are many particular stories about individual circumstances, each of which deserves to be told and told well. That includes those who stay in the church, those who leave the church, those who leave and return, those who convert to the church and find they must sacrifice existing lifestyles and relationships, those who find they aren't really gay after all, those who find they aren't really straight after all. All kinds of experiences, all of which deserve to be told well and sympathetically. Life and experience are diverse. From the reading and research I've done, as well as my own life, I'm convinced there's just as great a variety among those who are Mormon and homosexually attracted as there is among those who are Mormon and heterosexually attracted. There can be no single archetypal gay teen Mormon novel because there's no single gay teen Mormon experience. And so while I'm hoping that readers will enjoy No Going Back and that it speaks to them in meaningful ways, as one who believes in the power of stories to change how we think and feel about the world around us, I also hope for more stories by many different authors with characters who are Mormon and gay, a diversity of stories that will help us to imaginatively experience multiple ways of living and being. With any luck, a few years from now, the title of my talk will still be just as inappropriate as it is now. Not because the category is so small, but because there are far too many good candidates to choose from. Thank you.
As a person.